This podcast is brought to you by the Albany Public Library Main Branch and the generosity of listeners like you.
What is a podcast?
God, Daddy, these people talk as much as you do. Razib Khan's Unsupervised Learning.
You know that genetics plays a huge role in our health, and more people are using genetic testing to determine risk for diseases like cancer for themselves and their kids than ever before. So I want to tell you about ORCID. It's the only company that does whole genome testing for embryos, testing before your child is born. If you're doing IVF, this is a clear choice now, because now you can reduce risk for thousands of single gene disorders, including heritable forms of autism, pediatric cancers, and birth defects. Check them out at ORCIDHealth.com.
Hey, everybody. This is Razib Khan with the Unsupervised Learning Podcast, and I am here today with a returning guest, Dr. Christian Christiansen. He is a professor at University of Gothenburg, and he is also affiliated with Copenhagen University Center for Geogenetics. Most of you who, you know, read my pieces on Substack and follow historical population genetics and ancient DNA, we'll know the Center for Geogenetics. Eske Willerslev is leading that group, and actually a substantial number of researchers, to the point where the papers probably have a large enough sample size where they could do some reasonably powered GWAS. But the list of authors is substantial, a substantial proportion of the nation of Denmark, perhaps. But in any case, Dr. Christiansen's been on a lot of papers out of this group. And as you guys know, ancient DNA has produced a lot of work. And so I have not talked to him in 3 years. I talked to David Anthony last fall. That was an awesome update. And I thought it was important to touch base with Dr. Christiansen, who covers a lot of the same topics. I described them as friendly rivals. I don't think that they have like massive methodological disagreements, but usually their papers are in parallel. And I think competition is good for those of us who are consuming, because otherwise they might take a little more time. But anyway, there's been a lot of work that's come out, and Dr. Christiansen has also written some book chapters and whatnot that have a broader view. Instead of like drilling down on specific results and trying to understand the general processes and dynamics. And those of you who listened to the first podcast from May of 2021 know that he is a systems thinker and has tried to think about kind of like the global context of what happened with the Indo-European migrations, the Yamnaya migrations in Europe in particular, and how it might analogize to other areas of the world. And, so I'm touching base partly to get a status update, but there's also several specific papers that have some interesting findings that I want to talk about. And, Dr. Christiansen, it's been 3 years. What have you learned? I mean, like, what are the big things that you've learned? Like, tell us.
Well, I mean, what we have learned, is of course that, two things. When we increase the number of genomes, we also get higher resolution. And can detail in much the processes of migration, and in a way it's also a kind of response to the debate that's been going on over the last 3 or 4 years or about how can we contextualize the genetic results in a proper archaeological way. And make sense of it archaeologically. So I've been concerned in a way to build bridges over the last few years to integrate better the discussions between ADNA and archaeology and linguistics, because it's quite demanding. And I've also been trying to sort out what part of that discussion which is useful and needed, what kind of it of the issues are related to that we simply do not understand each other. I mean, that we assign different meanings to the same concepts like population or admixture or ancestry, you know, in some fields like anthropology, or some archaeologist will attribute to these terms something, you know, loaded by history and perhaps implicit racist implications. Whereas for geneticists, these are neutral mythological concepts. So sometimes, you know, issues, debates arise over assigning different meanings to words. So it's important that you sit down and, you know, clear up things like that. Then, of course, there are the real issues where what happened in history is really at stake. How are we to understand it? And one of these issues, of course, was the debates that arose from the original papers back in 2015 about massive migration from the steppe. You remember that title? And of course, it raised a debate about, yes, but it may not be it's so simple as we think. It may be genetically speaking, yes, that there is something massively going on, but in archaeological terms, how massive was it? How fast was it? You know, what was the speed of it? You know, was it hordes of people, or was it small trains of people over 100 or 200 years? So, you know, these are things I've been discussing. And the third big issue that's been coming up in the last 3 years is really that we have been able to detail by studying in detailed cemeteries where we have like 30, 40, 50 individuals, and we can start, you know, getting the real, you know, biological mating patterns that we can then try to translate into, you know, what were the rules of marriage, of fosterage? What kind of kinship did these societies have? So, you know, I think a lot has happened clearing up misunderstandings, perhaps sometimes, trying to understand the language of each other, in short. And I summarized that in a recent book last year, or was it 1.5 years ago, in an Element book called Archaeology and the Genetic Revolution in European Prehistory. 60 pages. There I try to summarize this. And now, of course, your question is, where are we heading now? What is the absolutely most recent stuff that we have been doing, right?
Actually, I do have a specific question on misunderstandings. Because I come from a genetics background, and I can follow that technical detail pretty closely. I saw an archaeologist compare unsupervised admixture analysis to qpadmin, which obviously are going to give somewhat different results across two papers, assuming that the papers contradict each other. But obviously, unsupervised admixture is going to give a somewhat different result than qpadmin, which makes it, you know, more of an explicit model. So that's like a technical confusion. I have a question in terms of, like, what do geneticists get confused about in the technical aspects of archaeology where they just can't follow the field, and so they get a little, you know, fuzzy about it? Like, is there anything you can specifically think?
Well, you know, I think a lot of concern has been for archaeologists to get to understand the work that genetics work, right? What are the implications, really? I think that what genetics have been trying to do, and what has been coming very much clear to several of the leading geneticists, is that the conditions for a successful collaboration between the disciplines, you know, you have to devote more time to understanding the archaeological context. You don't need to listen to a lot of book, but you have to listen to a lot of discussions around the table and some PowerPoint and things like that. But also, it's very clear, both to the groups in Harvard and Copenhagen and Max Planck, that you can see it in the papers, in the supplementaries, that that the description of the archaeological context of each sample is much, much more detailed now and comprehensive. You devote much more energy and time to getting it well described, so you make the supplementaries a really useful starting point for new discussions. And it also means that you are much more aware of the contributions from your collaborators to the archaeology. You simply listen more to that discussion, take more of that discussion on board. And I think the third thing I would say is that right now it's clear that you don't start a project with a lot of genetic analysis of samples and then invite the archaeologist or the linguist. You start out with inviting archaeologist and linguist when you have an idea for a project, and to sit around the table and formulate the research questions together. So something, I think, a lot has happened in that respect. I mean,
yeah,
the kind of projects that I have been running with Eske, some of it has been financed from Sweden, some of it has been financed from Denmark through Eske's applications. We have each of us has been on board and been part of writing the grant applications. So I mean, we are really sitting there. I think it's essential that we share this vision of where we are going, what are the research questions, because that determines also, you know, what are the kind of samples we need, what are the kind of, you know, work involved, who else shall we invite, and things like that.
So, you know, I want to get into the details of what we found out, but I do want to ask one last question about these sorts of collaborations. You're talking about linguists, archaeologists, geneticists. My personal impression is the historical linguists in particular have been pretty well aligned with a lot of the geneticists. But there was a faction, I'm going to call it a faction, I don't know if that's the right word, of archaeologists that were very skeptical of the geneticists, kind of, you know, marching in an imperial way, like a horde, you know. Do you think that has changed over the last decade? And it seems like archaeologists are more looking at genetics as just part of their toolkit. But that's just my impression.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, obviously, in the beginning, it was, I mean, there was some post-traumatic stress, as it were, simply because it was a bomb that was thrown from genetics into archaeology, at least in Western Eurasia, that a lot of the things we have been saying and believing that there were very few migrations were simply wrong, right? And this, in a way, demanded a lot of rethinking. But that's also an interesting challenge, and we have been debating this, but we are still in the process of expanding our theoretical understanding of, you know, the repertoire of migrations, which and also the things like how does language and genetics and culture, archaeological cultures interact, and how do they influence each other? So we are, in a way, in an incredibly interesting and productive also theoretical development of how are we to turn this into new models. You know, and the project we have been running, one of the projects we've been running was actually with geneticists, linguists, and archaeologists sitting around the table. And we had a conference 4 or 5 years ago in Gothenburg with Eske, that was organized by Eske, myself, and Gus Cronin. And the result was published last year. And I think it's a sign of the times we're living in right now in archaeology, that this book has actually now been awarded the best scholarly book prize by the Society of American Archaeology. And we will get it, you know, it will be announced and handed over here at their meeting in New Orleans in April here now soon. So I take this as that we are really into a productive interdisciplinary collaboration right now. And in a way, you could say, if we are going to talk about losers and winners, I mean, ultimately, this may be a simplification, but one has to say that by the end of the day, if we look back over the last 30 years or 40 years, who got it right? The historical linguist actually got it right. Their methods and interpretations were clearly more robust.